My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've come a very long way to give this talk, so I've been granted 20 minutes. I'm glad to be here. I did enjoy the 10-minute speakers very much. I want to thank the last young man, John. Is that your name, John? For cutting your speech short, so I have 23 minutes. I want to greet everybody here, people up in the Half Measures balcony. I had an interesting experience on the way here today. I was telling them at the airport about it. I was on a plane coming from Jacksonville, Florida. I was in Jekyll Island over the weekend. And I was sitting in a little area where there was no one around me. It was a little mosquito-sized plane. And I was sitting there, and I heard a voice say, "My, that's an attractive jacket you have on." Where in the world is that coming from? And I just ignored it. And the boy said, "And you're looking very healthy for your age." What in hell is this? I called the flight attendant. And I said, it sounds ridiculous, but there's somebody talking to me here and saying nice things. She said, "Oh, sir, those are your peanuts. They're complimentary." Anyway, I was listening to the talk. I guess this is kind of a sponsorship meeting tonight, which is a good topic, always in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sponsorship goes back, you know, there are people still in AA who said the book doesn't mention sponsors. It's just some thing people use to get attention or something. But actually, in 1960, I went to the International Convention in Los Angeles and heard Bill Wilson say, "I would like to introduce my sponsor, Ebby." And Ebby was his sponsor. In fact, that had been a very strange relationship. You know, Ebby called on Bill, and then Bill got sober and stayed sober, and Ebby never could stay sober. He got drunk intermittently from then on. And he finally sent him to Texas with an old guy named Circe Whalen. They're all dead now, so they're going to talk about them, I guess. And I'm not feeling very well myself. Anyway, this is a sidebar. I don't know why it popped my mind. Since Circe sent down this guy, Ebby, and Ebby kept him sober for 7 years. And while he was getting sober in Texas, I was in Texas, and they sent me to Circe for help, and I declined to accept it. But anyway, Abigail stayed sober 7 years, and Bill was so thrilled that he brought him out to the International Convention, and he gave this talk. Then he went back to Texas just absolutely irate. He said, "Damn it," he told Circe, Circe's old me, "Bill Wilson got all the attention all weekend. I'm his sponsor. I should have gotten more attention." Completely oblivious to the fact he hadn't been staying sober, you know. And he got drunk again over that. And Bill had to come down and find him in Texas and take him up and put him in a rest home in northern New York, and that's where he died. But as the first sponsor, I guess. But there's one thing I want to put a background here a little bit. All of us know, I suppose even the new people know, that once upon a time Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience in a town's hospital in New York. He'd been unable to stay sober, but now he is able to stay sober. And Ebby talked to him about finding a power greater than himself. We don't want any unnecessary movement when I'm talking, please. Oh, yeah, some other things I want to tell you, too. This is the signal for spontaneous applause. and this is for muffled sobs. But anyway, so Bill Wilson somehow got the idea that he'd been given some sort of a spiritual message by God that included him helping people stop drinking, because that's what Ebbie had told him about. So he went to the Oxford Group. Very few people know what the Oxford Group was anymore, but what the Oxford Group was is kind of an interesting thing. In 1907, a minister up in Pennsylvania felt that Christians were getting too far away, getting too soft, getting too far away from the basic drive of the old first century, where people were willing to be crucified and burned upside down and all for their faith. So he started a group called the First Century Christian Association. And it really didn't draw a lot of people, you know. I hate to have nails in my hands, Reverend, don't you know? And it didn't, but he had got a few old cultists. Then after the First World War, he went to Europe and tried to talk it up. And of all things, the students at Oxford University thought it was a wonderful thing, you know, all this dedication and so on. And they really took it over and made a big thing out of it, and as their spiritual values enhanced. And so it became known as the Oxford Group. Then in the late 1920s, he came back to the United States, now with the imprimatur of the Oxford Group, so he was able to get a little attention. And pretty soon, by 1930, there were Oxford little groups all over the country. And what they really boiled down to, eventually, was better type people, you know, wealthy people, better type people, meeting in one another's homes and discussing how they could enhance their spiritual values and their beliefs. And it was a very, very nice, touching thing. Well, Bill Wilson had this idea that he should be able to help drunks through the Oxford Group. So he started going to the Oxford Groups, and he'd pick up old, dirty, slimy, sweet street drunks and bring them to the meeting. And these people, you know, just... I believe you're vomiting on my shoes, sir. And they weren't thrilled about it. They finally gave a little area they called the alcoholic squad of the Oxford Group. And then he'd take them home, but they had no place to stay. He had a couple of people living in his home, off and on. And he was just trying to help people incessantly, every day. And one morning, after about 6 months of this, he got up and he saw that the guy he brought home the night before had taken the coffee pot, apparently to sell it for wine or something. And he watched his wife putting on her old clothes. His wife Lois had been a kind of a society sweetheart when they got married, and now she was old before her time, salt and pepper hair, old clothes with a patch on the sleeve, working in the basement of a cheap department store so she could make enough money to pay the rent so Bill could go to the Oxford meeting for no value whatsoever. But he got up and saw that, and he had a terrible sense of remorse. Well, look what I've done to my wife. My drinking, I'm unable to help her. She's working, and I'm a bum. So he said, Lois, I'm done doing this. I thought I had some calling to help drunkards, but I don't. It's just some fantasy. I thought that maybe it's just a fantasy I had in that room, in the hospital room. And he said, I'm going to stop doing this. I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to let you quit your job. And I'm shoveling dirt. I'm going to do something so give you some reward for your efforts. I have been trying to help people for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober, and I'm done with it. And right then, your life and mine hung by a thread about this big. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her about 40 years ago up in Connecticut. And I asked her, how did you ever think and say that? You changed the lives for all of us. She said, oh, it didn't seem so odd to me. What he said was, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. And he went, oh, yeah. That's why old Heimers don't have much hair in front. You just go through like, oh, yeah. You must have done it a lot. Anyway, I did. And so he went down to see he knew what he had to be doing something wrong, because not one person had ever stayed sober. And he went down to Dr. Towns, or doctor at the Towns Hospital, his old friend, and said, "You know, doctor, I'm trying so much to help these people, and I can't seem to help them. And the doctor said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm taking them to Oxford group meetings and tell them about the Oxford group therapies." He said, "That's your mistake. You're trying to get them sober through Jesus. And drunks don't get sober through Jesus. Very rarely. You're trying to get them sober through religion. You didn't get sober through religion. Nobody else does either." He says, "Well, I suggest you do." And he said, "Let me start with this premise." He said, "You know, drunks, alcoholics are people, they seem to have an invisible shield around them. They get all kinds of advice, and the advice just bounces off. There isn't a person in this room who hasn't had enough advice to last them 10,000 years. And the mental attitude is always the same. I know you mean well, but you don't understand. My case is different." And so I said, there's nothing that I know of that gets through that wall. He said, "But what you might true is this." He said, "Why don't you try, instead of giving him religion, talk to him about why you drank and how you feel and what drinking does for you. I can't talk to him about it because I don't understand it either. But you do, and maybe that'll help." And Bill said, "I don't know what good that'll do to just tell him I'm another drunk like them." But he went home. And when he got home, he found a letter from somebody on Wall Street. He'd been a big shot on Wall Street and drank himself out of it. And said, "We've got an opportunity for you, Bill. We're putting together this machine tool company in Akron, and we need some proxies laid together. We're going to send you out there, and I want you to get these proxies going, and you'll become president of the company. You can bring your wife out there, and you'll have a great life. But if you screw up, don't even come back, as far as I'm concerned." He says, "Because I'm going out in a big limb. Everybody says, don't trust Bill Wilson. But I'm going to trust you. But if it blows up, don't come back." So Bill, full of excitement, went to Akron. The deal blew up. And he found himself on a Saturday morning standing in his hotel lobby and reached his pocket. He had a $10 bill left. He could either pay his hotel bill or buy a train ticket home. He didn't know what to do. And years later, I stood in that spot trying to recreate what his feelings must have been. We're all a little bit of a fanciful people. And over here, there was a door about where that door is over there. Only over it, it had a little curved sign that said cocktails. And the jukebox music was coming out and the clinking of glasses. As he wrote later, he had a feeling that I understand, I'm sure you understand too. He thought, "This is quite a quandary I'm in. If I had just one or two drinks, I could think of an answer." We all know that feeling. And he started to go. And every step he took, our death appeared imminent. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw across the lobby, there was a few payphones on the wall, little phone booths actually, and over them was a sign. In small town hotels, they did then, like maybe they still do for all I know, they have the leading churches and the ministers and their phone numbers. And he had promised his friends in New York that he would call somebody in the Oxford group before he did anything rash. So he went over there. Took out a nickel, which is what the phones cost. Went to the first number, dialed it. Man said, "Hello." He said, I'm Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hunk from New York. I've got to talk to somebody in the Oxford group. Could you help me out?" And the man said, "I don't know what you're talking about, sir. I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me." Hung up. Next number didn't answer. Next number didn't answer. Next number... Man said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And now what would have been, you know what my attitude would have been at that time? I did what I said I would. I gave it a shot. And if he'd done that, we'd all be deader in the nut house. But as he turned away from the sign, he noticed the bottom minister, a man named Walter Tunk. That's what I should call, get another rejection from Walter Tunk. That would make my day complete. So he called Walter Tunk, who turned out to be the only man in Akron who could have helped him. He said, "Funny you should call. I was talking to one of my parishioners yesterday, and she told us that her Oxford group meeting this week, they have a doctor in their Oxford group who admitted he was a bad alcoholic and he couldn't help himself. And they all prayed for him, but it didn't seem to do much help. Maybe I can put you in touch with him?" He said, "Yes, yes, that sounds good." So he said, "Wait in the phone booth." So we called the wealthy parishioner on the West Akron. She was a divorced wife of the heir to the U.S. Rubber Company. Had a big home out there. And he said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, yes, Dr. Smith. We all felt so bad for him. Let me see if I can get in touch with him, and we'll put him in touch with this man from New York." So she dialed Dr. Smith's house, and the phone rang and rang and rang and rang, and she started to hang up. Oh boy, "Hello, I'm sorry I was out in the yard. What can I do for you?" And they got talking. He said, "There's someone here. Maybe you can help the doctor." And Mrs. Smith said, "Well, I hope so. He can't talk to him today, though. He's drunk on the floor. He can't get up. But maybe we can do it tomorrow." And the parishioner said, "Yes, bring him out to my mansion here." And they talked for a while. Then the parishioner called back to Dr. Tunk. They talked for a while. Completely forgot Bill Wilson in this hot phone booth waiting. And he's just ready to go right then, you know. Bing. Yes. And they give him directions on how to take the streetcar out to the wealthy woman's home. So the next day was Mother's Day, 1935. And Bill Wilson took a streetcar out to follow the directions, and the doctor came out. But he was too sick and hungover to drive. He had a son, 16, named Young Smitty, they called him, and a daughter, and his wife, and he. And he and his wife sat in the back seat, and his young 16-year-old son drove the car. That 16-year-old son later became a leading speaker in Al-Anon years later. Some of you have heard him. He's dead now. And his sister over here, but he is a rather close friend of mine. I always enjoyed hearing him tell the story about driving out there and his father in the back seat, so hungover and sick. "And I'll talk to this guy for 10 minutes. But I'll do this because it's Mother's Day, and I've ruined your Mother's Day. I know that. But God, I'm not going to sit in this to be lectured at again. I'm not going to be lectured at again. I'll give him 10 minutes, honey, and that's all I'm going to give him." So they got out there. They had a bite to eat. These two guys went into a room for their 10 minutes and stayed in there for 4 hours and came out. The doctor said to his wife, he said, "My God, Ann, I've never heard anybody who seemed to know how I feel. And why I drink. And what a few drinks do for me." He said, "My God, it's a miracle." This was Bill Wilson's first attempt at a 12-step call. Without a 12-step. And he turned to Bill. He said, "Bill, I've just overcome with this. Could you stay with us a couple of weeks maybe and we could talk some more about this?" And Bill thought, "Let's see. I have nowhere to get out of town." "Yes, I can." So they talked every day for 2 weeks about the verities of the spiritual program of the Oxford group and how drinking could be put aside. And they just wondered. The doctor just expanded beautifully. At the end of 2 weeks, he said, "Bill, this weekend in Atlantic City is the American Medical Association convention. I was there last year and I was so drunk. They laughed at me and they ridiculed me and they made fun of me. And I'm going to go there this year and show them what I found. You stay here with my wife and get Zombie back Tuesday morning. And away it went. Tuesday morning, phone rang at 7 in the morning. Woman on the phone talking to Mrs. Smith said, "Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. This is the doctor's office nurse. They carried him off the train today so drunk he couldn't walk. And he knew that I worked for him, so he called me. And I'm with a cab driver. I've got him back here in his office. And he's lying on the floor crying. And he's so sorry. And I regret so much that it didn't work out." So Mrs. Smith and Bill Wilson came down and got this drunken fool and took him home. Of all the bad things I know about working with people, among the more sickening is crying drunks. Jesus, they're dreadful. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." Boom! Now you're sorry. But they got him home and put him to bed. A couple of days later, he sat up. He said, "What day is it?" "It's Thursday, Bill." "Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I've got to do a cancer surgery today. And I put it off so many times. I'll lose my license if I don't. And look at my hand. I can't hold a knife. My God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do?" So his wife and Bill got him up and bathed him and got him dressed. And his friend Bill got him some beer to steady his hand. And away he went to the hospital. "So I'll be back about 2. And he came, 2 o'clock came, and Bill, Dr. Bob, didn't come back. Nor at 3, nor at 4, nor at 5. Obviously, the son of a bitch was drunk again. 6 o'clock, the door burst open. Here he burst in cold sober. He said, "Boy, do I feel great." He said, "Where have you been, Bob?" He said, "Well, I was doing that surgery, and I was thinking, you know, in the Oxford group, they ask you, you're supposed to make amends to people. And I never thought a doctor should have to make amends. But as I do that operation, I'm a human being first, then a doctor second. So I've been all day all over Akron making amends to people I've screwed up and hurt. And I feel wonderful." And that was June 10th, 1935, which is considered the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. Although it wasn't any Alcoholics Anonymous, it was just two fools in the Oxford group. But it was the basic egg. But they realized one thing from that, is that they hadn't got, Bill, Bob did not stay sober by talking about deep spiritual values. Bill had not stayed sober. I mean, Bill did not stay. He stayed sober by trying to help people, by talking to people, by making what we call now 12-step movements. So they knew they had to find some old bad drunk to talk to. But in those days, the 1930s, nobody ever could go to the hospital for alcoholism. You had to have something physical, gastroenteritis or some hideous, some mal or doing of your organs. And so they'd book him in and some. And Dr. Bob called up his nurse at the Akron Hospital, who was a nun named Sister Ignatia, and see if there's anybody up. Another little sidebar. Now, this may or may not have happened. I can't remember every detail. But in 1960, Sister Ignatia talked at that same convention where Abby talked. And I listened to it, and I went up afterwards and thanked her. And I think I gave her a kiss on the cheek. And then I think I said, "Oh, is it all right to kiss a nun?" And I think she said, "As long as you don't get in the habit." I can't remember every little detail. That's over 50 years ago. Anyway, she said, "Yes, I have a man here from a lawyer from Louisville. He moved here to get away from his drinking. It's gotten worse and worse, and he's in terrible shape. Maybe I can get him to talk to you. I'll have to check with his wife." His name was Bill D. I heard him talk 45 years ago or something. And he said, "I was laying on that bed in Akron, Ohio. And my wife came to me and said, 2 men want to talk to me about my drinking.' And I said, 'Absolutely not. I've talked to all the people about my drinking I'm going to talk to. I'm sick and tired of talking about my drinking to people who don't understand. I'm not going to do it.' but my wife's a rather strong woman. So I talked to those two fellas. And they never talked about drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt and why they drank and what it did for them. And I thought to myself, my God, I've never heard anybody describe me before. This is remarkable. And he said, I stayed with those fellows, and he became number three in our chain. And then they had some, you know, the three of them working around Akron trying to get people into the Oxford group so they could be heard and stuff. And of course, it was a terrible thing because they'd talk to people, and a couple I dealt with, you know, the Oxford group, they'd tell them about Jesus for 2 hours, they'd forget all the things they heard and everything else and go get drunk again. But they got a few people. Another little sidebar. They got a young guy named Ernie, who is 29. They said, you probably can't be an alcoholic being that young, Ernie, but you sure drink like one. You come with us and see what would happen. So he joined them. And then he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and brought our organization its first relationship. I don't know of a word that sends a shiver down a sponsor's spine worse than that. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. But if you're smart, you have a phone on your desk that says, And they say, I think classic, I hear people say things like, gee, Clancy, I knew I thought the old one was the one, but when I saw Doreen walking out of detox today, they got married. Perfect ending to a perfect lovely moment. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, who you know, married a guy I sponsored named Tom Nutman, and he was a Nutman too. And he was 5 years over. I suggested they not get married, but my daughters all knew more than I did, of course. What does an old fool know about that love? So they got married. And I want to tell you the absolute epitome of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything because it's the sanctity of the fifth step. You can give little clues. Let me know if he ever brings the sheep home, honey. And they got married, and they said, you know, you're a young man. You should take care of your wife. You don't have to come to our meetings again for a while. Get you settled. Be a good husband. Be a good homemaker. Stay there. And we'll take care of the drunks. So he stayed home, and they were surprised when he got drunk and turned her against AA for 50 years. And they didn't realize that good motives don't keep you sober. But all of the whole point of what I'm trying to make is this. Those things were the creation of the 12-step call. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And now, you know, when Bill Wilson wrote the book, 2 years later, 3 years later, there are a couple things that there's a question about the 12th step got under a lot of heat because it said, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. And after the book came out, people said, Jesus, Bill, you're the only one who had a spiritual experience. We didn't have it. You had it as a result of these steps. You hadn't even written the steps yet. How do you explain that? The book sold very slowly, so they had a lot of time to think about it. They sold about 10 copies the first month. And they finally realized that it had to be a change somehow. But that apparently, in some way, they could not understand. The 12 steps brought about a gradual change instead of that, boom, that Bill Wilson got. So in the second printing, they changed the 12th step to read what it reads now, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We had to practice these principles and carry the message to the alcoholics who still suffer. At first, Bill had written to carry this message to others, which is written now in Al-Anon. But they said, no, we can't carry the message to others. You only got a message to carry to people with alcoholics. So they put in other alcoholics who still suffer. And so the 12 steps and the 12th step became the symbol of sponsorship. For many years, many people have complained to the World Service Office and all these other, keep grinding us about our, oh, the singleness of purpose. For Christ's sake, get off it. We don't talk about singleness of purpose. Today, young men, young women take drugs. They come to AA, and we tell them they can't hang around here unless they're an alcoholic. That's wrong. And they use the great phrase, it's all one big, no. You won't be clapping in a minute. They say it's all one big disease. Now, I'll tell you, because I've been sober a long time, you know where that phrase came from? Of a treatment center that only had one van. But then why do we have the singleness of purpose? For a very simple reason. Because that's what the 12-step work is. Alcoholic talking to alcoholic. And I'll tell you something else. In the late 1950s, when I was just newly sober, there was a guy in Los Angeles named Jim Willis. And he was an alcoholic, but he's also a terrible gambler. And he got sober today and he felt good. He started bringing his gambling friends in to try to help him. I don't want to hear those juicers. Come on, I got nothing common with those juicers. So he wrote to New York and got the first permission to use the 12 steps outside of AA. And he founded Gamblers Anonymous. And 2 years later, the Marina Del Rey, all these happened in Los Angeles. I knew all these people. Some guys formed Cocaine, or in the North Hollywood, they formed Narcotics Anonymous. Then they founded Cocaine Anonymous outside. Then in the Mid-Wilshire area, they founded Overeaters Anonymous. Why? For one reason only. Because they discovered without identification, you couldn't get through that wall, no matter how smart the things you told them. And they all had that wall. And I never really understood. What did you miss? What were I talking about when you left? Anyway, I know why I'm never invited back places. I try to be nice, God. Anyway, I was about 2 years sober. I'm staying sober now. I'll tell you why in a minute. I was scrawny. I weighed 124 pounds. Had no front teeth. But I was finally staying sober after 10 years of slipping. I was just on fire. And I was speaking at the club one night on obsessions. Not the recovery from them, just the obsessions. I didn't know how to recover from them. And I got done and some kind of plump woman came up and said, that's wonderful. She said, I started a group for some folks called Overeaters Anonymous over at Christ the King Church on Olympic Boulevard. Could you come over and talk to our ladies on Sunday? I said, sure I can. Give them something to shoot for. So in this room, there's about seven or eight rather plump women sitting around a table. And I gave them an excellent talk on obsessions. I know they were good because they were agreeing, you know. Then I got done, sat down, glad to be of service. Then they had a little sharing session. And over here, a woman, she her son had just had his 10th birthday. He was at a military school in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to Long Beach to get the boy to bring him back for his party. And she took out the cake and put the candles on and got the decorations up and thought, I hope the cake is good, tested it, and tested it again. By the time he got back, she'd eaten the whole cake. And she felt so, she cried. And I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I wanted to say, no, just eat a piece of cake and let it go with that. What the hell's wrong with you? You know? And this woman over here, crazed about ice cream. She can't wait for her husband to go to work. He's a famous doctor. But she couldn't wait to go to work down to Rite Aid and get some ice cream. Eat ice cream. Just loved ice cream. It empowered her. Gave her, but all day long, she'd eat ice cream and sneak it at night if she could. And I didn't say anything. I'm a nice guy. I wanted to say, no wonder you're fat. Christ's sake. Woman over here was my favorite, though. She ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her fingers down her throat and puked it up. Then ate some more. I didn't say anything because I'm a nice guy. But I wanted to say, don't bother shaking hands, so. Miss Slimy Finger. I mean, I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot. My God, Saturday afternoon, sun's still up. I'm going to miss the fun tonight. Now, what was the difference? I'm smart. I knew exactly what they were saying. And I had a certain empathy for it, but I didn't understand it because I did not identify. It was just odd behavior to me. That's something all of us have to work on. Sometimes we try to wonder why our folks don't understand our alcoholism. Because it's just odd behavior. When it doesn't do it for them, they'll never know what it's about. And that's why they say odd things like, you mean you can't even have a glass of wine at Christmas? No, of course not. Don't be upset. They don't really can't understand it. And that is why we have all those programs. Because the thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous work is not that it's made up of such wonderful information. You can find the information in Alcoholics Anonymous in other places, other books. But it gets through that wall. That's what it's about. Getting through that wall. And you can't even always do that. But at least you got a better chance. And that's why we have such a strong book about singleness of purpose. People say, but I want my son, I have a grandson right now who's just coming off heroin. And his mother's been in AA for 22 years. And he's a young man. And I've tried to help that kid so often. And he's got some goofy narcotic addict who's sober helping him. And he's just blossoming. I want to just shake him and say, I said you better things than that, for Christ's sake. But he's getting through the wall that I can't get through. And I've talked over beyond my 15 minutes. Can I have 5 minutes more? I'll take as long as I damn want to. The reason I believe in sponsorship is because I stayed sober, could not stay sober for years. I went from being a high-bottom drunk. I was a very good advertising writer. And I got, little by little, I screwed up medium-bottom drunk, finally a low-bottom drunk. The last day of my alcoholism, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, stay out of here, you phony son of a bitch. I tried to explain to him. I'm not a phony son of a bitch. They had me front teeth. I couldn't say it clearly. I said, 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Delmer ad for the Borden Company, if you remember those old ads, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that old mission. It was raining, it was cold. I couldn't think of a single person in the world that would accept a collect phone call from me anymore. But I'd learned one thing. Whenever you get really smelling bad, as I was, and I just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. So I was covered in blood and vomit, and my clothes were torn, and had no clothes, no money. I learned one thing. There's always one place where you're welcome. Try to find an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Fred. So I found an AA club, and I walked. He told me where to go. I went off, set off in the rain. It turned out to be 72 blocks away, 7.5 miles. I just got to be just like the Bataan Death March after a while. So I didn't know anybody in that town. I didn't know where I was going. And then I got to this club at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax. I started to go in there. I almost didn't go in. There was a guy in the doorway saying, "Welcome home, son." When I went in and I hung out all day long, stand to stay out of sight. Because when you're a long-term slipper, you know what's coming. There's going to be somebody over there with a book pretty soon reading to you. And just you check. Here's what it says on page 184. Screw you. So you stay out of sight. None of that, there was a meeting. And everybody in the club had to go to the meeting. Not just wait for it to stop raining. And at least they served cake. And I had about 4 pounds of cake, so I could chew that. Then they had a meeting on gratitude and almost vomited it up again. Then everybody went home. Just the manager and I were left. It was still raining. And I knew he was about to say, "You got to get out of here." I thought, what am I going to do? So I had one tool left in my toolbox. I just thought I could look like a newcomer if I worked at it. So after this guy said, "Hi, I'm a newcomer. I have no place to stay. It's raining. Could you help me?" He says, "You're not getting out of Joe Quinn left the 49 Merc in the parking lot this stuff last summer. That's rubbish. You can sleep in it. It doesn't dry." I said, "You mean to tell me the Los Angeles answer to homelessness is sleeping in an abandoned car?" Said, "Yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah." I remember sleeping in that car that night and my mouth started to bleed. The next morning I came in another meeting. And just hideous. And finally, Sunday night, the manager called me over and said, "You know, kid, your stay here is over, really. Because you're allowed to come in the club on weekends, but during the week you got to be a member. You can come in during the meeting, but you can't come in during all day long like you've been doing." He said, "But on the other hand, if I make you stay in our parking lot in the rain, you're going to die. Then I'll have to fill out all those forms." So he said, "I'm going to let you come in the club with 3 rules. You can't ask anyone for money, which you've already done. None of your sarcastic remarks, which you've already said. And every night you have to go to a meeting." I thought, "Oh, Jesus. I'd almost rather be dead." But I did. Okay. So Monday night I went to my first meeting and ate 4 pounds of cake. And had no idea that would be my sobriety date. I didn't want to be sober. I had no desire. You know, the third tradition that was read so well by Miss Brower tonight. I want to tell you something. You know about the miracle of AA. 45 years ago, I was working in a big advertising agency in Los Angeles. And I got a 12-step call from some dingbat, blonde, bubblehead. I said, "Come on down, have a Coke with me." And the bed of Coke was just, "Oh, And I know such people, there's always 2 things you can tell them, because they're always appropriate. "Go home and clean your kitchen and clean your bathroom." "How did you know?" The last thing I would have thought is that 45 years later, that bubblehead would be a New York lawyer reading the 12 traditions in the long form. And she made me old before my time. But at any rate, why did I want to stay sober? Because to me, my problem is I'm not an alcoholic. That's the hardest thing. You know, sometimes you hear about this, about the problems. To me and people like me, I always raise my hand as an alcoholic when I'm scamming AA. But down deep, I know I'm not really an alcoholic. Here are these old guys. I stayed drunk around the clock 10 years in a row. I never did that. I worked in big advertising. I drank a little too much sometimes. Got in trouble once in a while. Got a lot later. But my problems. They say alcoholics can't stop drinking. I can stop drinking anytime. I've stopped time after time when necessary. My problem is not that I can't stop drinking. My problem is that I have some emotional quirk in me. And when I stop drinking, in the next day or 2 days or 3 days later, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out of saying, I need a drink. It comes out of just restlessness. Little irritability. Come on! A little tired of the daily sermon from the kitchen about what I did the last time I drank. Why don't you shut up in there? Little by little, watching whatever technicolor there is left in my life slowly go back to that damn gray. And after a while, my job is gray, and this house is gray, and these people are gray, and the whole damn thing is gray, and it's impossible to survive. And I discovered how you beat that. I'll tell you how you beat that. You take, you don't take a bottle of water, but you take a bottle of vodka. Lord Jesus, that's good. Oh. But then you have to say, I'll watch it this time. Never know, I can't watch it. But in the mid-1950s, I went through a little spell of my drinking, where when I get to a right about, I'd find myself out in the streets counseling police officers. Dumb. I was thrown in jail several times. Not for being such a bad thing like you hear, but just an old drunken ne'er-do-well. And I'd get out in the morning. I'd get out in the morning, go home, take a shower, and go to work. And I came out one morning, and one of my neighbors was there. I said, you shouldn't have come down here. This cop, I got his badge and I'm going to get his ass. He really was so abusive. He said, I don't know about that, Clancy, but while you're out drunk last night in jail, your son died and we couldn't find you. And it just about crazed me because I had one little boy and three little girls, and he was the apple of my eye. And he died. And God, I was in jail. I was in jail. And we took him to Wisconsin and buried him at the foot of my wife's mother's grave. And I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Emmethlin, this will never happen again, I promise. This will never happen again, I promise. And I came home. I started doing something I hadn't done for a long time. I started coming home for dinner every night with my children. And I didn't go to AA because AA makes me want to drink. I quit drinking. And I would help with the schoolwork sometimes, and sometimes we'd go for a ride after dinner. This was, I was living in El Paso then. I was in El Paso 2 weeks ago. I was able to recreate, I went to visit all the scenes of my sadnesses. I had my oldest daughter with me who was now a judge, but at that time she was just a little snot. We had a little prayer before every meal for baby John. Just wonderful. And we had some good times. We laughed together. My kids and I played games together. Just fun. And wouldn't you know it, one night after about 2 or 3 weeks, somebody snuck into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day it wasn't too bad. Just a little tense, not bad. But the day after that, it started getting bad. And pretty soon I was just, damn. And all of a sudden I had a great breakthrough. The God, the Norwegian Lutheran God that I always believed in, and believed in that day and believed in now. I realized what he had done. He had taken my little boy, who never committed a sin in his life, and killed him to punish me. Screw you, God! You'll get me in hell, but you won't get me before that. And that was the end of that. I never wanted to be around anybody ever talked about God again. But the days kept going. They really are pretty tight. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For God's sake, I'm sorry. I don't mean to holler at you. We'll play tomorrow. I just go to work. Hate the damn job. Hate you sticking down. And I needed a drink so bad, but I promised my dead little son I wouldn't. So I didn't. And one morning I got up, I was just crazed. My wife had taken the children to church. And I pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose to the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what to do. And the guy next door happened to be sitting at his breakfast nook having a cup of coffee. And he saw me go in and the motor ran and I didn't come out. So he wandered over and he found me dead in the car and he pulled me out and they beat on my chest and breathed my mouth, called an ambulance. They took me to the hospital, oxygenated me and worked on me for a couple of days. Then they determined, why would he do this? So they gave me some psychiatric tests and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life. You think that's funny? Wait till I get to the point where I die of cancer. You like that? But I went to the insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas. I was there a long time. You know, I didn't get out till the next year. And the only reason I got out there is they put in an alcoholic ward run by an AA guy who didn't know that I'd been around AA for 7 years. I gave him the right answers, and I eventually got out as a cured alcoholic. But I'll tell you, it's tough when you're in advertising and a good writer, when you got those 6 and 7 month holes in your resume. What were you doing in that period? Well, I was self-employed. I was working for a company that later disappeared without a trace. You just want to put in the state insane asylum. That cuts in your employment. But that's how I guess when I stopped drinking, because my problem, I don't know how to explain to people. Alcohol, when I don't drink alcohol, I'm weak and fallible. When I drink alcohol, I'm good, and I'm slick, and I'm hip, and I'm cool, baby. And the only problem I ever had is when I drink a little too much. Then they think I'm a drunk, but I'm not. You know, for years, I've been talking. I've always tried to, how can I synthesize alcoholism to put it in like 2 sentences, the germ, like, you know, Einstein created the theory of relativity, and it took 20 years to think of E equals MC squared. And a month ago or so, I think I stumbled onto it, at least for me. Alcohol enables me to become something I'm not. Alcohol keeps me from being what I am. That's all. That's just covered my life. I was just trying to learn to control it. And so I never wanted to stay sober. That's why I didn't say, I want to stay sober. I got sober this time. Sooner or later, I'll go to the insane asylum. I'll commit suicide, some damn thing. And in that first week, I stayed going to meetings and living in that abandoned car. I saw a guy in the meetings who I'd seen in the movies, a movie actor. What does that tell you? Rich. That also tells you he probably would like to have a new friend. I kind of moved in on him. He didn't want a new friend, turned out. Kept raining. By the end of the week, the Friday, it was bad. And I was getting bad, and I knew I had to get some help. But if I went out that rain again, I was going to die in that street. So I did something I had tried never to do, my one element of maintaining my integrity. I had never sold out. But this time I sold out. I went to this goofy actor and I said, Bob, I really admire your program. Would you be my sponsor and help me? I said, okay, kid, but I want you to tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I found out shortly thereafter that he was not a movie star at all. He'd been in 3 movies. He had little cameo roles in 3 movies. I've been in more movies in the last 5 years than he ever was. But I didn't know that then. They said he wasn't a very good actor. But he was a good actor because he acted nicely in meetings. That took a lot of acting for him. He was a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Just Do this. Why am I taking this crap from this guy? Because he was the only guy I could see as a meal ticket out of there. And he'd come down once in a while, pick me up at the club and take me out where he was speaking. He was a man of strong opinions. And I told him, I said, Bob, I know you're trying to help me. But I'll tell you, frankly, I'm not an alcoholic. I have a lot of emotional problems. I may be mentally ill, but alcohol is my best friend. I just got to find a way to control it. And I said, yeah. And he took me up one night out to the Mallet, out to the Brentwood meeting, which was at that time the biggest meeting in town. He was the speaker. And as the meeting started, some kid got up and wanted to talk 5 minutes. He said, I wanted to tell you all that I came here 11 months ago, and I was having a lot of problems with my family and my job, and you people pointed out to me that I drink too much. I never even thought of that. And I stopped drinking, and I haven't had a drink since. My job is going good. My family's doing well. Perhaps you wonder why you haven't seen me back at the meetings. Because I've had no desire to drink. It was just a wonderful thing. Thank you. And he sat down. And after the meeting, I saw old Bob pounce on him. You got no business being an A. What are you hanging around here for? Jesus. On the way home, I said, Bob, what do you grind that kid for? Because he's got an alcohol problem. I said, Bob, I hate to tell you this, but A is designed to help people with alcohol problems. He says, no, it isn't. We don't want people with alcohol problems in the mission. They're just taking a waste of their time. They don't need A. What do they need, Bob? They need to stop drinking, clean up their act. When they're offered a drink, say no, thank you. That's all. I said, are you kidding? I've been trying that for 10 years. I've been in jails 30 times. I've been in nut houses. He said, I guess because your problem isn't alcohol, kid. You must have what I have and everybody else in AA has. What could that be, Bob? He said, something sounds like alcohol and fools a lot of people. It's called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than you'd ever believe. Alcoholism. Hooray, I'm cured. Shut up, he said. And he gave me about a 3-hour harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But in that 3 hours, he changed my life. He pointed out these things. He pointed out again why alcohol and alcoholism are different. He says they look the same. You start off by taking a drink. But the thing about alcohol is this. You can stop drinking and you clean up your act and you can do pretty well. However, this strange thing called alcoholism, this mind perception distorting, bodily eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard that before. I've been to meetings for 10 years and now I was talking about getting sober is the answer. He said, ah. Getting sober and not doing anything about it is worse than drinking. I said, huh. Why do all these alcoholics drink? You know, say, well, I drank and I put me in jail and all, and then they lost everything. I said, why do they drink if it's so terrible? He said, kid, you don't even know very much. He said, they don't drink it because it's terrible. They drink it because it has an unusual effect on them. Do you understand that? I said, yeah. I said, set up the phenomenon of craving. Then they drink, until you go crazy. He said, nah, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink, kid. And he had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, if this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink. The result would be to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. Things would get a little softer, just a little friendlier. And I have a couple more drinks and I'm starting to be the kind of person I want to be. And I'm hip, slick, and cool, baby. And he had also had a theory on the phenomenon of craving. You know, no one's ever been able to describe the phenomenon of craving, explanation for. He had an explanation that I wasn't sure was true, but I believe it's true now. He said, when you drink, It puts you into a different place. But pretty soon you feel, you start to sag a little bit. You instinctively take another drink to hold it. Then you start to sag a little. And you keep doing it, all of a sudden you're drunk, which you didn't want to be. You just wanted to hold it. Just hold it. I said, Jesus, Bob. I've been doing that for 10 years. I thought I was the only one that did that. I said, but there's a girl in our group who said she was sober, then she drank again, got sober again. Why would she do that, being sober so wonderful? And he had another theory that I thought was stupid. I heard a tape of it 30 years later. I thought, maybe he's saying, I guess it's true. He said, when people like us, we'll learn something. Growing up, when you're growing up young, or as you get older, it's not easy to grow up because, you know, people are not interested in what you got to say or your emotions are out of whack. And every time you fall in love, you're going to have somebody break your heart. And they expect you to deal with things you can't deal with and crises and have to work through painful situations. And eventually, you don't even know the goal. The goal is to reach a stage of emotional maturity. If you can reach a stage of emotional maturity, you can live a pretty good life. You seem to instinctively be able to hold a job as long as you want to. Get along with your co-employees without even trying. If you're married, you know how to get along with your mate. You know how to treat your children. You have a sense of being a parent. Get along with the parents. Get along with the neighbors. Go on square vacations. Have a good time. So this is wonderful. But this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because part of that maturing process is living through painful situations. And we have learned we don't have to. We can drink them away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch, I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And they all work, because I've done them all. But he said, every time they work, they leave a little, apparently leave a little cold, invisible ball in your psyche. Don't even know it's there. You do this enough times, you get a whole bunch of them in there. And they never bother you once, till you try to stop drinking. Then that seems to activate them, and the buzz starts. And then it's a matter of time before either home, job, street, someone arouses your emotions. For example, someone does something that hurts your feelings a great deal. Someone rejects you. Someone puts you down. Someone makes you feel you're not really welcome. They're trying to get at you. You get thinking about these people. Sometimes you can get to a point where you're lying awake at night thinking about that son of a bitch. I wish he'd get up. And scientists say you can get to a point, people actually get to a point, where you literally must drink to preserve your sanity. Isn't that ironic? Drinking makes us insane, and yet you get to what? And you drink, which starts to fire going again, pretty soon you're gone. I said, my God, Bob. That's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I really was something. I made a lot of money. But I just couldn't control my emotions. I got in trouble. And now I'm lying, living in an abandoned car, taking crap from people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn last year. I said, my God. He said, there's a name for people like you. I hated to ask him what it was because he was so profane, unlike me. I said, what could that be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, but how could I be an alcoholic, Bob? My problems are emotional. They're not, I drink a lot, but. He said, kid, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. And if your answer is alcohol, you're screwed. Because you have that problem for as long as you live. That's why, Jesus, Bob, why doesn't AA describe it the way you do instead of this pony allergy, the body, obsession, the mind, imitation, psychiatric crap? He says, they do, kid. Look on the wall. Quite simple. All we ask you is this. You have to admit you're having a problem with alcohol. Then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you must also admit you're having a problem without alcohol. That's all. It's no big sinister thing. That's all. And he said, if you weren't, you wouldn't be riding with me in this car. Not say this to anybody in this room who's new wondering if you're an alcoholic. If your problem wasn't alcohol, you wouldn't be here. If sobriety was comfortable, you wouldn't be here. You get driven in rooms like this when everything going to hell. And your mind says, what are you doing here? These people are goofy, for Christ's sake. You got to work through that. But that was December of 1958 that I determined I might be an alcoholic. And I found it hard to accept. But I knew one thing. The thing that made me feel good. Maybe I'm not secretly insane after all. Maybe my emotional explosions are part of a pattern. Maybe they're not caused by some weakness in my brain. And I never had another drink or another pill. And little by little, he took me through the steps and the traditions and stayed sober. But the greatest gift I ever got in my life was discovering I was an alcoholic when I knew I wasn't. I couldn't return to God. I told him, he said, time to work the steps. I'm going to go through the steps. But he said, time to work the steps. I said, Bob, I cannot return to God. I'm not going to return to God. He said, you're lucky. Nothing today asks you to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob? Does that fool the other boys and girls? Doesn't fool me. Because it doesn't say that either. Read what it says. It says, come to believe. We never ask you to go back to any old childish misunderstanding. Come to believe in something. Can't you believe in a loving God? I said, no. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Said, of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that. And he became my higher power. He got me to do things that nobody else ever got me to do. And he died, finally. Old before his time. But he died, and by the time I was doing well, I was working in advertising agency. I was slick, hip, slick and cool. And I was doing great. And I didn't see any need. I thought, who could I be a sponsor? There's nobody, not even Bill Wilson. He's on vitamin B now, to hell with him. There's nobody big enough for me. And on my 7th birthday, I was speaking at the Southern California Convention, Sunday afternoon meeting. And in the middle of the, a woman brought me up my cake. And everybody on that program were people I sponsored. Oh, it was just wonderful. And on the way home, I was thinking, you know, I'm walking example of the power of A. I don't need any help. I thought, what if something bad happened? Who would I call? And I couldn't think of one person I could call that were up to my standards. And I remember there's one guy in Los Angeles named Chuck Chamberlain, who was a good AA, but I hated him because he was so spiritual all the time. And I thought, maybe I'll ask that old fool to be my sponsor. Give him a break. So I called him at home and I said, I'd like to talk to you tomorrow, Chuck. He's okay, come down to my office. I went down to his office the next day. And I know he's going to give me some spiritual words. God wants you for a sunbeam, son. Boom. And I sat down. He said, yes, what can I do for you, kid? I said, Bob, it sounds odd, Chuck, but I decided to come down and ask you to be my sponsor. He said, really? That's surprising. I was at the meeting yesterday where you spoke, and I thought you had offered to come down to be mine. And I thought, this rotten old son of a bitch isn't so bad after all, you know. He was my sponsor for the next many years. But one thing he said for me, one day he said, you know, I never hear you talk about God, Clancy. You talk about a higher power and all these people. I said, God, Chuck, God hates me. And I hate God. And I, when I was a boy, I was catechized and confirmed, and I went through the church, and I did very wonderfully well. But when I got drinking, he turned on me. I said, God hates me. He said, Clancy, I have some bad news for you. You're not important enough for God to hate. I want to say, yes, I am. Yes, I am. But I thought about that, and I went home that night and tried to say a little prayer. Thanks for God for keeping me sober. I thought there'd be a Norwegian Lutheran explosion. Oh, there he is now. Whoop! Yeah. But he did. And somehow over the next few months, I began saying my prayers, and I, little by little, over periods, I came to believe in a loving God, something I never thought I'd do. I couldn't have done it when I was new at all. But it's a result of doing other things, making amends and doing things. And I'm happy to say that for the last 48 years, I've never gone a day without praying earnestly to God for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. I don't dare ever pray for anything, because that's what I do. I deal. Here, God, get me out of this, and I'll help the poor. Just think about that. 11th step, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the courage, power to carry it out. Because we're all just a bunch of finaglers. And I know that it has enabled me to live with some degree of comfort and grace. And I became somewhat successful. When I was 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. My family had returned. We had another little boy. And I discovered something about AA that maybe if you're new, you'd come to believe. You know what A is for? You look at me, I've been sober 53 years. If you get drier and drier and drier, and one day you burst into flame. But I'll tell you what A is for. It took me a while to understand. Alcoholics Anonymous, I firmly believe, is designed with its steps, its membership, its fellowship, its sponsors, its steps, to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. It has changed my perception of reality, changed my relationship to the world around me, enables me to live without the fear of someone's passing remark will destroy my day. And it made me feel so good that when I was 15 years sober, one day I left a job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 38 years, I've run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you give up your career to run that mission? There's no good answer to that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't turn it down. I got to be here a couple of days more, but Thursday morning, I'll get up in Los Angeles, and I'll go down to Skid Row, my office. I park under the building, this terrible, wretched area. Take my walk around the building that I do every morning. Step over the bodies of people dying from alcoholism and drug addiction. See who had a convulsion over the weekend and had to be taken away. See who died from an overdose of that goddamn crack. And go into my office and spend the day with my colleagues trying to find ways to get these poor bastards off the street. Because, you know, on Skid Row, it's almost impossible to get them off. Because it's not an economic thing. It's a mindset. They've given up. Here's an interesting little statistic. There's never any suicides on Skid Row. Isn't that funny? You'd think that'd be the number one place. But suicides are caused by the battle between your inside and your outside. And they've given up the outside. And that's why they can't take any conflict at all. But we can get a few of them. We get a few. Then I'll go home and have dinner with my wife and my daughter who's staying with us, taking care of her mother because she's sick. Then I'll go to a meeting and I'll judge the speaker. Then I'll go home and go to bed and sleep well. It doesn't sound very exciting for the life I've had, but it's a good excitement. Because if you're new to that, I would say one more last thing. We talked about it in the sponsorship, as the true of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA tonight in New Jersey is exactly what it was in Akron, Ohio, 1935. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different, at least enough, so that he will take an action he does not yet believe in. And that is the ember of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then you have to blow on it, take good care of it. Surround yourself by people who are carrying a little tinder. Little by little, flame burns up. And one day you're walking in the world with a degree of confidence. You never become wonderful, despite what some speakers would have you believe, no matter how hard you work the steps, how long you stay sober. You never rise above human being. And human beings are fallible. And everyone in this room knows there are some days that you know by 10 o'clock that this is a shitty day. And so what you have to learn to do is just hum to yourself, come on, midnight, come on, midnight. It's going to be better tomorrow. Because A, really works, makes you feel good. Hope you try it. Thank you.